Hello and welcome to the Art Monthly Talk Show. I'm Chris McCormack, Associate Editor at the magazine, and today I'm joined by Morgan Quaintance, who will discuss his new feature in the June issue, Class Distinction. The text weaves together numerous viewpoints diagnosing the absence of discussion of working class lives in the art world, lives that are typically spoken and described by others, and we'll talk in more detail about who they may be. It does this through a recent exhibition at Two Temple Place and through other kind of analyses and other kinds of viewpoints as well come in here. You really excellently weave together. Morgan, I wondered if we could begin by saying, or asking you rather, what led you to want to write this article? I think it's clear why, but I think it's good for the listeners to kind of, you know, where this has come from and where you're sort of positioning this article today.
Okay, so I think a lot of the article, really, there's a personal like impetus behind the writing of it. Essentially, a lot of the let's say feelings of discomfort and disorientation that I track in the article have been things that I've experienced myself. And I suppose I wanted to tie in maybe the anecdotal with a more factual and theoretical analysis of this phenomenon of what I was calling, let's say, the erasure of working class experience in the cultural sector. Like what I found throughout my time of being someone who is a cultural producer, say, is that there is always this, like I say, like an erasure of a working class history of cultural production. Mm-hmm. And like you can even think about that from bands like Depeche Mode.
Yeah.
Depeche Mode, very working class band, you know? Yeah. And that aspect of Depeche Mode is not necessarily foregrounded when they're discussed. It's almost like you have to discover it by accident. Oh, they're from Basildon. Oh, they're from, I think it's Basildon that they're from.
Yeah, and like, they are. Yeah.
Someone's parent was like a milkman or something. Yeah. You know, it's like, it's very, all of these times when you discover like significant cultural figures come from working class backgrounds, it's purely by accident you know, initially these things happen when you're inexperienced or a new initiate into the field. And then after a while, as someone who's observant, I suppose I start to connect the dots between that those casual encounters where you have to discover a history, to link those with this like sense of alienation, a sense of I guess in some ways discrimination, but it's never really direct. It's usually quite oblique. Mm-hmm. So it's like connecting the dots between, as I was saying, kind of personal feelings, anecdotes, encounters, and then a more theoretical analysis of that.
Yeah. And I think that's true, isn't it? I mean, certainly, I mean, we'll talk a little bit, I mean, even myself, I mean, I come from a working class background, so I think we share some kind of commonality here in this position of like how we've encountered the art world. But before we get into these micro details about our own life, it's very interesting to try and untangle or sort of articulate something about how we want to describe the notion of working class communities and identities. And I think we need to start talking about that a little bit as well.
Yeah, so what I wanted to try to do at the beginning was to do a very like basic definition of what I considered a working class individual or community to be or to stem from, right? So I was like, well, the one commonality that I think that I could say would sit at the foundation of a self-identification or an identification of a community would be this one element, and that was limited economic means. And like in the article I was saying, well, in less administrative terms, it's poverty or the experience of relative poverty or being poor. And I was saying that what that means is that certain experiences, social, cultural, administrative, juridical, political, will be yours. Yeah. And those experiences will also be shared by people who come from a similar economic background to you. And those experiences are, what I was saying, character forming. It doesn't necessarily mean that the working class is this homogenous entity where everybody has exactly the same experiences, everybody has exactly the same consciousness. It is rather saying that within this notion of a working class community or working class individuals, there is room for difference, there is room for different disagreement, and there is room for like diversity and conflict. But there is one unifying element, and I felt that maybe the least contentious of those elements would be coming from a place of limited economic means as a point of origin.
Yeah, and I think it's important then, as you do this sort of analysis, how you place this within, as you describe, a dyadic analysis with middle class values or middle class sets of cultural and financial stabilities. Do you want to talk a bit how you place these two classes in conversation with one another, but also try and avoid one that is just, I guess, historically been seen always as I guess some sort of form of conflict or easy conflict, let's say, or easy kind of depiction of conflict that reproduces these kinds of ideas of class in kind of tension with one another and in control of one another, or so, something of these kinds of levers of power.
Yeah, so one of the things I wanted to do was to like deconstruct this perception of working class people or working class as a kind of descriptor. And this one characterization of that as being something that comes from a place of lack or something that comes from a place of deficit. And specifically in our sector, that deficit is cultural. So the notion is that to be identified as working class is to be identified with an experience of cultural lack. And that the frequently recounted story in our sector is of a working class individual who comes from, let's say, a background where they're experiencing like a kind of cultural vacuum. But maybe they might be quite precocious and have maybe taken to the stories of like Dickens or Bronte, which is an interesting, we can talk about Dickens later, but Dickens or Bronte or any of the other classics, and then are like remarkable for their precocity, right? And then they are exceptional in their family milieu and are accepted into somewhere like let's say a Russell Group institution or some other place where they experience this this dissonance between a background where they come from but feel alienated from, and a cultural future where they don't feel that they belong, but it feels more comfortable to them. And it's like in order for them to access culture, they have to leave behind their working class background and move into like a middle class zone in which they are either outsiders or they have to become middle class in order to like access the thing that they are sort of craving for. And I wanted to trouble that notion, or maybe just like broaden it out to say that is one particular experience in, let's say, a larger portfolio of possible experiences of working class life in relation to culture, but it is not the only one. And to also draw attention to how that is frequently deployed as the only working class experience. And that is also done in a subtle way. It just means it's not necessarily like somebody is every year defining working class experience as that explicitly. It just means that the books that tend to be commissioned about working classness or the articles that tend to be written often privilege this particular point of view. And there are many people who have had that. Like we can talk about, let's say, Hilary Mantel, for example. Or even Jeanette Winterson, you know, both of their autobiographies discuss a kind of puritanical working class upbringing where the Bible is the only kind of like book in the house. And then they discover, I guess, in the case of Jeanette Winterson, aspects of her own sexuality through literature, you know. And but often these, while they are legitimate, they tend to be the only voices that are allowed through. And let's say from the case of a black perspective, often, well, this is maybe moving on slightly further than we were discussing, but class isn't necessarily talked about, but let's say the black experience is often represented in cultural production as something that always comes from a position of lack and poverty, or yeah. So the idea is that maybe rather than the kind of Hilary Mantel, Jeanette Winterson novel, where it's like I've come from a region, it's a very puritanical, like the C of E upbringing or Catholic upbringing, and then I've moved into culture. You have this other one where it's like the urban environment, and you know somebody is involved in forms of crime, and then all of a sudden they have this like moment where they realize there's more to life than the petty crime, and they access culture through the institution, but they still have this in each moment. There's this spirit experience of betrayal or not feeling like you belong somewhere. So I really wanted to take that apart and show that that was actually a fallacy, and that there was something a little bit more sinister taking place, albeit in a very subtle English way. That it was like it wasn't necessarily by explicit obstruction. It was just by a process of subtle filtration that what the narratives that come through and that get taken as standing for the whole are ones that have a very like narrow view of experience, working class experience.
Yeah, I think you come up with this, I thought, excellent description with that, with the mezzanine level, sort of idea that, yeah, we can never progress further. It's this kind of holding space of a narrative where, yeah, we're in these, like, as if we're climbing stairs all the time in society, and at some point we just hit this mezzanine level, and then there is no further progression. We're in this kind of neither in nor out. And you, I think you mentioned Cooper, what's his name?
Dennis Potter.
Dennis Potter, yeah.
Dennis Potter. So Dennis Potter, I think it's called Between Two Rivers. You might be able to find it on YouTube, and it's him. He's from a place called the Forest of Dean. I can't remember exactly where that is, but he's just recounting this experience of like estrangement from his father, and the kind of awkward exchanges they're having when he comes back from, I can't remember which institution, if it was Oxford or Cambridge, that he was educated at, but coming back in the holidays and his dad kind of hovering at the corner of his bedroom, wanting to engage with him, but there being this like non-traversable intellectual divide between the two of them. His father being like, I think, a manual worker who had all his life, and his son just entering this rarefied world of I guess intellectual knowledge or and maybe the reason why this has been reproduced so many times is because it has a kind of melancholy literary quality to it, and that might be why on one level people are comfortable with it. And then again, I was mentioning a book by the Birmingham-born writer Lindsay Hanley, which was a sequel to her book called Estates, and this one was called Respectable. And what I found interesting about it was that she was recounting this experience of like education, again, this the same thing of like class migration. How do you move from one class to another? That how uncomfortable it can be. And I felt that there are a number of assertions in the book that went by without critique or comment. So one of them being that. There's a scene in the book where she discusses how she was in a classroom, and I'm probably not framing this in the right way, so it's going to be a simplification of it, but she describes a scene where she's in the classroom and she's wanting to learn, and everyone's kind of messing around and feeling that there was this big separation between her and the rest of the kids who were kind of just not getting on, who weren't interested in learning and kind of bettering themselves. And I thought that's one account of it. But another account could be that school is just pretty crap. Like I went to school, and I went to eight different schools before I went to university, and was expelled from a couple. And because I thought it was rubbish, like there was nothing that I was being taught in it that was of any real use or interest to me. And for me, I'm proudly identify a kind of what some might say an oppositional, defiant attitude to institutions, but I prefer to look at it as like a kind of the easy iconoclasm that comes from this class position. And what I wanted to try and say was like, okay, if you are trying to survive as somebody who comes from a working class background, you are kind of surrounded by individuals, institutions, like historical articles, forms of cultural production that are essentially reinforcing that you're not worth much. So you quickly have to make this, you have to have a kind of critical consciousness quick, even though you may not identify it as such, you know, because maybe you're not privy to like continental theory when you're 6 or 7. But you know, you have to get a sense of pride from somewhere, because otherwise you're going to be like you know, born down or ground down by this environment that is essentially undermining you. And I think part of that critical consciousness comes in people's disruptive behavior at school, state school, especially state schools that are designed to tell you to stay in your place, be quiet, don't ever question, don't ask, you know, just be this like cog in a machine and go out and work and have your weekends. You know, you can be aware of the futility of that like normative framework, even if you don't have the vocabulary to take it apart at a young age.
Sorry.
Yeah, so
I was going to say, I think it's also like where you reach cultural access as a child. I think you talk a little bit about growing up in London, and I think, I mean, I would imagine that's quite di I grew up in Liverpool, so it's I think that's quite, I mean, in a way there is the similar contour, you know, it's a city, it has these kinds of, but there is, I think there are specific differences about that. But I think it's interesting how you talk about the kind of network around you and the kind of various places you felt growing up. I think that's a very interesting point you made.
So what I was trying to do is then say, okay, well, you can't just set up this, you can't, what, I guess what I was trying to say was like, this experience of migrating from one class position and then moving into a middle class position and feeling a sense of betrayal and disorientation. What I was trying to say was maybe we can track that geographically. Maybe it's not necessarily about creating a hierarchy of experience, and it's not about saying one experience is more valid than the other. It's about saying, okay, difference exists in this class position, and where is it situated and how is it distributed? And I was thinking, possibly, you know, it's a regional experience where if you come from a city where exposure to culture is quite difficult anyway, then it's more likely that your experience might be closer to that, no, that state of affairs where it's like, yeah, you're coming from a background where it's like Rita Sue and Bob Two type situation. You know, you're on a kitchen sink estate and there's not much happening. But I was trying to say that, well, let's say in metropolitan centres, that's going to be different because everybody's on top of each other. And also, you have more facility for those people who have already made that migration from the region into a capital in order to pursue a career involved in cultural production. But on differing lines from like the institutional conventions. So for my own background, which I pulled into the article, was saying, well, I grew up in on the borders between Clapham. Well, I grew up in Lambeth on the borders between Clapham and Brixton, and I grew up in a milieu that was working class, that was queer, that was involved in activism, involved in politics, involved in like community volunteering and community care, like as just a given. And it wasn't all great. There was lots of violence, there was lots of dishonesty, but what it meant was, it meant that I was in, it meant that there were, let's say, a network of informal cultural institutions that I was surrounded by. And I'm using the word institution to talk about like actual spaces, but also just modes of thinking, established modes of thinking. So one of them would be like the existence of squats. Like I was surrounded by quite a lot of people who are involved in like, let's say, traveler networks or processes of doing fringe theatre, like where the Battersea Arts Centre was that down the road from me. And in Brixton, there was a place called Coltan Arts, which was, there was a lot of, yeah, squat raves. And you know, these things were almost, I took them for granted when I was growing up. You know, in a way, I was like, I'm not really interested in them. They're kind of all around. But as I was getting older, I realized that they were actually really valuable. And I also realized that the primary school I went to was a place called Ashby Mill, and it's now been it was turned into luxury flats in like 2000. But when I look back at some of the pictures from the school, because there's like a Facebook page, I realize how radical as an institution it was. Like, we observed boycotts for apartheid in South Africa. We had specific like cultural sensitivity days, but they weren't called that or anything. But it just meant that I knew about Eid. I knew about like certain forms of cultural production in Ch sort of cultural practices in China. They were all observed, and also the staff that were working at those institutions were quite like radical and countercultural people, and I didn't know that then. So I was lucky to just be surrounded by this sort of stuff. And so it meant that when I came into contact with, let's say, more middle class people who lived in the same area, more often than not, they would have been brought up outside of that. You know, see what I'm saying? They weren't surrounded by this like informal network of like anarchist institutions or squat groups or people, and it was more a conventional. So by the time we became teenagers, they seemed really adrift. They're like, on basic levels, that's like to do with slang. I remember having to like teach people like what this word means, what that word means, you know, and like this is what this music is and this is what that music is. And so what I was trying to link my own biography to is this notion working class as an experience of cultural surfeit or cultural abundance and not cultural lack. And to say it's really important to then link up these different experiences from like from the regions and from like metropolitan centers, and to say, well, maybe it's because the working class is so atomized in this country that the regional experience of alienation has been taken as the whole. Because it does something, it reinforces the perception of the working class as a position of lack. Rather, maybe I was thinking about this, what's happening is the, let's say, the regional working class who might have this experience of coming from a place of like a cultural vacuum, say, on what in one sense, they're being disinherited from their cultural inheritance because they're coming to the city and they don't know the history of the people who've made the journey before. They don't know the history of the people who are already active in the center and are working class, and they don't know the networks that they can connect to find people who are similar to them. So what they have to do is move through a kind of middle class, established form of entry into a zone of cultural production, which means that they encounter individuals who make them feel alien and other all along the way. And then it involves archival work or your own kind of social sleuthing to find this history of people who have been there before you. And so maybe it's also about trying to say that working class experience is differentiated, but it's linked by this element of limiting economic means. And in order for us to kind of stop this overarching definition of the position as lack, it's about linking up these communities that have been historically separated, atomized, and then latterly pitted against each other. Because like this thing of also characterizing the working class as white and then also as right wing or like more prone to vote, I'm doing scare quotes, you know, prone to vote for Brexit, it's also making this like antagonistic relationship to a multiracial and multicultural working class. And obviously, I think for my position, and I'm not a Marxist, but I'm just somebody who sees reality for what it is, you know, there's a vested interest in pitting these communities against each other and separating them, because if they did get together and started vocalizing their positions, then it would be very threatening to those in power, you know?
Oh, completely. And that's what we've seen repeatedly, I think, this idea of divide and rule across, as you're saying, very much about how these working class people from who have actually a huge amount in common are often treated as against one another in order for those, the powers that be to continue to divide and to overthrow or continue their power, really.
And one of the like just quickly, but one of the things I said in the article was just to show I missed tracking it to the specific date, but what I was saying was, after 2008, you could see it happen in sort of real time. We had the global financial crisis caused by who? Bankers, right? And doing these, like, I think they were called credit default swaps or fake securities or whatever. And then there was a brief moment where bankers were under the spotlight, right? And then pretty quickly there was an about turn, and it was poor people who were to blame. And like very quickly, the BBC, Channel 4, and Channel 5 as well were bringing out these documentary programs that were spotlighting so-called benefits cheats. You know, I don't have statistics to hand, but we know that whenever anybody does, the existence of benefit fraud, when it does actually exist, is so minuscule in relation to like GDP or whatever that it barely warrants a
Well,
mention.
yeah, it's
But
negligible, yeah.
yeah, but they're it's just like a useful scapegoat to project all the ills of society onto. And then also, I guess, as a kind of historical consequence of them shifting the perception of working class people, it is even effective within the community itself, because this blame gets internalized and we're all demonizing each other, you know?
Yeah, well, that's the thing, isn't it? I think we see that repeatedly, these effects of how working class people's lives are being depicted largely in a negative way. And I think even from my perspective, I think I remember this subject you were talking about, it was very not really spoken about, certainly in the art world and for many years. And I think only after maybe 2008, 2009, the credit crunch and all those kinds of where I actually noticed increasingly where middle class kids still couldn't get on the property ladder. And you started hearing like words like precarity coming into discussion much more because suddenly those people's lives suddenly were being affected in ways that I think I probably just got used to. I mean, that was just my life. And it's just interesting to see those kinds of those narratives play out in different ways across other people's lives and backgrounds. But these kinds of storylines we've lived through, and
You know, it's interesting because that is a good point about this notion of like all of a sudden care is like it's a big topic in the sector, and yes, precarity. Whereas we've been, ex I would argue that people from a working class background experience these things as a standard, but they haven't been important until they started to affect like a kind of more of the middle class demographic. But I also think one of the things that we're still lagging behind on a little bit is just the what happens then. I think this distinction is that when people come to a kind of critical awareness, not through life experiences that take place early, but through a kind of a process of inculcation that happens in a university space, they're less it births a type of intolerant pedantry. What do I mean by that? What I'm saying, like, coming from a working class background, you're kind of aware that everybody's under massive amounts of pressure. Let me just give you a concrete example. Like, I live in Essex Road in a Peabody housing estate, and across from me, there's a couple that argues all the time. Yesterday they argued for 6 hours, roughly. Like, but during the day when I was at home moving around doing things, it became explosive. The man slapped his partner and she was asking him to leave for the whole day, and people were walking past and listening to it, and nobody was really doing anything. To be honest, I didn't do anything either, but it was rooted like this happens every day more or less. And I was thinking to myself how these kind of clashes or crises, like existential or sort of social, are like a daily experience for people in these positions. And that, how can I explain it? So you're kind of more sympathetic to difficulties with that other people might face, if you know what I mean. But when you have to kind of learn about that experience through a text, then it's almost as if you're following like the guidelines of social intercourse laid down by the text as opposed to laid down through experience. I'm just using that as a way to discuss encounters I've had in the sector where it thinks of itself as caring or progressive, and it feels as if I'm being treated according to a set of criteria that someone has digested from a book. You know? Like I remember I was involved in a like an alternative education, and when I came in to have a meeting about a teaching session, the person in charge said to me, "Oh, you know what? The assignments that you set for the class, you should also do yourself because that is how we foster a more like inclusive and non-hierarchical balance between student and teacher." And I thought that's someone who has no experience of like horizontality or working with people in this way, but has just read that in like Paulo Freire's Pedagogy of the Oppressed or something. And you know, I guess it's another way of thinking about forms of knowledge that we've accumulated over time that within this new economy of care and diversity and diligence are not necessarily recognized as being a level of sophistication above somebody who has read about it in a book and then tries to enact it. But in some ways, a lot of the tensions that we're living through in the sector come about because they are being administered by someone who doesn't actually have actual empathy, but they have a kind of book-enabled sympathy, you know, theoretical sympathy.
It's all rote as opposed to actual lived experience that's kind of driving that stuff. I totally agree with you. I mean, I guess for me, I guess on my level, it's more I guess I can pass, or there's a kind of code switch that I can, it's not, if people find out I'm from Liverpool, instantly it's presented as, oh, you must be, I mean, one is de facto poor, which is quite amusing. But then I'm categorized as, well, maybe I'm from the Wirral, which is if the Wirral is a wealthy borough. And I go, well, actually, I'm not from Wirral. Not that even Wirral is distinctly just all rich. I mean, there's very poor parts of the Wirral. It's just fascinating the kind of, and then they go, oh no, I can hear you're from Liverpool now. You just sound like Paul McCartney. I mean, you get into kinds of anyway, I mean, it's just fascinating the kinds of the kind of loopholes and kind of machinations that surround the kind of anxiety of which you're kind of describing around encountering someone from a different class or someone from a different background, and also how we deal with them in a way that I think I know how to talk to people from different classes, different kind of backgrounds, because I've had to move through them or had to actually experience them. And they don't know how to return that space. They don't know how to talk to me, and they actually feel genuinely sometimes unsettled or off balance when I say, "Oh no, I'm from a working class background. I come from a council estate in Liverpool. I went to a poor poor education, poor background." And it's like, oh, they're suddenly dumbstruck by how someone like me is sat in the room talking to them and actually being able to navigate this space, and they cannot go back. They cannot repay that space. They cannot come at me with anything. It's almost, it's fascinating in a way, but
It's really like that's why I used that quote from Irving Goffman's Stigma book, where he was discussing there was a quote from a disabled person, and in the book it's very dated language. I think it's from like the 50s or 60s, I can't remember the date, but the disabled person says something about being crippled, and that's how they're using their own terms. They were saying that the cripple has to be a cripple, you know. If they're not presenting as other people expect a cripple to present, i.e., if they're being confident or if they're not bothered by their disability, then it represents a kind of threat to the quote unquote normal person viewing them. And I've recognized that same dynamic or energy. I feel that's what you're kind of describing also. It's like, you know, I'm not representing a threat, but there's something in someone else's sociocultural, like theoretical framework that they're not sure how to deal with. Almost like sometimes it's akin to when people have like cognitive scripts in their brains, yeah, and then they're uncomfortable with the notion of having them there, then some weird behavior follows. Maybe the classic example is like the man who's attracted to another man but can't deal with it because they're straight, you know, and then they just get angry, you know, like suddenly they like it's like not being able to acknowledge attraction because then it contravenes your self-image. But you can't even acknowledge that. So what you do, you explode and you become violent. And like, or it could be even, it doesn't even have to do with sexuality. It could just be if someone's nice. I remember like I was always use this example of like, I was doing some martial arts and I was just like a nice person, right? And there was a guy there who could not stand me. And I was like, I don't understand. And then like, I could, after a while, I was like, oh, it's about masculine presentation. I'm not presenting in this way that the space is like requiring us to present. And in some ways, I'm undermining his sense of self by being here and being like, hey, you know, and being quite free and open, as opposed to like frowning for the first 4 weeks, not saying anything for the first eight, and then like eventually being like, yeah, you're right, man. You know, like, you know, and I think, yeah, that's what you're describing in that in encounter. And it's just when people who maybe think of themselves as progressive and think of themselves as like socially aware suddenly are confronted with the fact that they're not. And that's quite, you know, that's that old cognitive dissonance situation. But you know, the thing is like, it's because of that stereotypical depiction of what it means to be working class and who it means to be working class. It's like just being in the cultural sector, it's supposed to be an impossibility, right? Like I was saying that a cultured working class person is a contradiction in terms. So your existence in the sector discredits your background. So in order for someone to be comfortable with that, you need to present as someone who's disorientated and upset and doesn't know who they are. But you know, like I was saying in the article, all along, some of the most important cultural figures in this country, and I'm saying important in terms of being popular, but important as being like canonical or responsible for creating forms of cultural production that are intrinsic to the like the fabric of certain forms of Britishness, right? Like Charles Dickens, William Blake, JMW Turner, you know, like this is England, you know, they are working class people. And you know, I was thinking about it as well in relation to someone like Terence Davies, you know, and also it's interesting that you say Liverpool as well, because Liverpool has this whole tradition of like, you know, like the Everyman Theatre. Yeah, it's like it has this strong, robust theatrical tradition that is rooted in working class experience, right?
Absolutely,
But whenever people talk about theatre, and it's always the National Theatre, or it's always, you know, like, you know, people, polite people in a room saying polite things to each other, or not so polite things, but indirectly.
I mean, but this is where we get to the current nub, really, which is to say, that's in a, like the kind of where those credentials were certainly burnished in Liverpool were in the 60s, Willie Russell, that kind of generation. There was a huge generation, and now, I think there's been a lot of discourse about the kind of lack of working class voices in the arts, partly because of the it, it's incredibly prohibitive to kind of think about taking on all the student debt. Also, there's very few careers opportunities that are there at the end of that. And so, for instance, there is a kind of concerted effort, but where I feel that that conversation's often landed is around theatre and around acting. And there's been, to me, certainly in a broader political or public level, that's where the conversation's been. And there's been a fewer or less attention given to the art world. And I think that's why there is a need for a corrective of some kind. And I think that's why this is a welcome article to talk about how we need to sort of talk about working classness in the arts. And I think this is a good step towards doing that. And also to talking about the way you do about people of color within that position and the complexifying of that space as well. Because as you're saying, it's homogenized through history as a white working class British position, which is not accurate and is not true. And it isn't telling the full story of that either. So, I mean, that's where we need to get to. And I think this article is trying to place that very succinctly and within our word count together, so we welcome it, I think. I guess we should talk a little bit about at least something about this show, because I feel like we talk about it rather than just the exhibition that you talk about at Two Temple Place. So let's at least give some space to this as well.
The exhibition Two Temple, the exhibition Lives Less Ordinary,
Yeah.
I think it's created by Samantha Manton. I don't have her
You
name.
do. You're right. It's Samantha Manton. Yeah.
Samantha Manton, yeah. And it sort of came out of nowhere for me discovering it. A friend of mine was, oh, should we go and check this show out? It's about working class artists, working class experience. So I was like, great. And it was at Two Temple Place. And I was like, oh, that's a really strange place for it to be. But actually, it isn't so strange. And this, so I don't know the history of Two Temple Place, but when you go, it's a very kind of posh building in some ways. It's a, got a, like quite an arts and crafts interior, I think.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm describing that in the right way, but
Well, it's all wood paneled rooms, basically. Yeah.
wood panelled rooms, like ornate carvings and that. But in a way, I wouldn't really describe it as posh. But we can get that. We could. That could be another whole other thing, right? But what I was trying to say, I'll just say one thing about the space and the exhibition being there. And what that related to in the article was that I was saying, you know, it's not drawing attention to distinctions between middle class experience and working class experience. It's also a way to draw attention to the stereotypes that are like, what, like imposed on both positions, right? And how the stereotypes are imposed in order to kind of orient someone's way through life and to govern chance your position. Your chances of doing certain things, right, and acting and behaving a certain way. And I was saying that, like, you know, the way through is for just to renounce both of those, to renounce this position of being someone who's lacking, and also to renounce this position of being superior to the person who's supposedly lacking.
Yeah.
And I was saying that these things frequently happen in the UK. You know, when we, yeah, there are class distinctions, but people frequently disregard them, you know. And one of the ways that that happens is often in these collisions between institutions that might seem aristocratic or somewhat elevated and more, let's say, earthy or like subaltern initiatives.
Yeah.
And I was really charmed that it was at Two Temple Place because you could tell, like, the people, the gallery guides were really excited by the show being there and were really excited to like tell you about the exhibition. And I could tell some of them kind of came from working class backgrounds and like, were like really proud to be in the space and to be sort of custodians of what was happening. Anyway, that's one thing. But the show itself was just kind of a fairly large group exhibition with like a multi-generational collection of artists who are working across photography, painting, sculpture. I guess forms of installation, filmmaking, and what Samantha Manton did was present a very, I thought, heterogeneous and differentiated account of working class life and working class cultural expression in a way that I hadn't really seen before.
Yeah.
So I didn't. I don't know if I used the word landmark exhibition. Maybe it's just a little bit debased because people are like overusing it these days.
Yeah.
But it really did feel a landmark in the sense that I hope that it's going to function as a kind of curatorial intervention and begin a type of discourse. You know, it lays a foundation that enables us to have these conversations and certainly enabled me to talk about this issue with that as that show as the backdrop. And it really, like I say, I think it shows walking through it. I mean, you can feel a through line, and I think again, for me, the through line is this basic unifying element of limited economic means. But from that comes just like a wealth of experience, a wealth of different modes of expression and ways of, let's say, figuring the subject in society, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also, I think just a brief point here, because I think that's actually a really interesting one you make, which is about post or early conceptual practices and the notion of dematerialization, and in a way, how that offered or proffered a space of something outside the commodified structure of art. And yet, somehow, unfortunately, it's become ensnared again within those very wheels. And I think that was just an interesting, adjunct point that you open your article with, actually, which is how art history, in a sense, has tried to posit this democratization of art, but actually how that has never, it has yet to kind of yield a true result or further results, really, in the world.
Yeah, and maybe in a way it was a sort of foreshadowing to the end of the article because I was saying, what's going to happen now? Well, what traditionally happens is, let's say, those who constitute the centre begin to co-opt the expression of a marginal group. And then in that point of co-op, that process of co-option, the complexity gets like playing down. So I was sort of saying, maybe we're going to have to be vigilant for that and try and prevent that from happening. And so rather than it becoming less complex, I think it's got to be more complex and more problematized because I think the more it goes, it delves deeper into the complexity and the difference and the difficulty in the subject position, the more the institutions around it are going to have to change. We still have, we're working in a climate where higher education is forbidding for anybody who doesn't have much money. What is it, like 9,000 a year? We're still in a position where it's cost too much money to live in the capital and possibly anywhere. It costs too much money to have a practice, have a studio. It's also really, really hard to wait for people to pay the invoices that you send them. And it's all geared, the sector itself, to a large extent, is geared towards satisfying the needs of a middle class person.
Yeah, or
Or
someone at least financially secure. I think there has
that's it,
to be
yeah.
kind of financial security at the heart of it, because otherwise, you really are at the mercy and the whims of wherever the la you're going to land. And I think that is it's a hard environment to live and work in, for sure.
Well, not to call out any institutions by name or not to, but I'll just to give you some insight. I'm waiting for about 7 grand. I know this is, I'm not saying this to say that like I have lots of money or anything. I'm not. Just I'm waiting and I'm chasing a number of people to pay me and it is just not happening. And I have to pay my rent in a couple of days, which is going to mean I'm going to have to go into debt to pay myself, and then I'm still not sure when the money is going to come to me. But this money that I'm waiting for is also going to have to stretch for the like the to the end or to the beginning of 2026. It's like there's this expectation that we all have a buffer somewhere, but I don't. People don't have buffers, unless I suppose they have some sort of bequest somewhere or someone that they can lean on. But even then, I think that's an unreasonable expectation. So I think it's funny because I was like, this I think is going to have to be like a part two, an unofficial part two to this article where I'm just talking about how, let's say, the whole structure of being an independent contractor working within the cultural sector is set up to satisfy the needs and the expectations of a middle class subject. Whether or not that middle class subject actually exists or is just this kind of phantom that institutions have been built around. In the same way that even though we don't talk about it, there are certain like protocols that determine the height of tables, the height of the sideboard, the size of a doorknob, and they're all determined according to a specific normal perception of a body that may not exist, but someone has determined it, So yeah, that's just an insight into what I was thinking about this morning
No,
when I
and
looked at my bank account and it was
but
empty.
I think actually let's talk because you talk about some organizations, and I think this is actually a useful tool. If you're talking about organizations such as TERF in Croydon, the other MA in Southend, Museum as Muck, White Pube, Working Class British Art Network, the Working Class Creative Database, and Working Arts Club, these are all listed in your article. So I think it's really useful and interesting to talk about these organizations and what that means for these kinds of voices, what we're describing, and what that might help, sh how this might help shift things going ahead.
Yeah, well, I think, like I was saying, it's going to help people feel less alienated when they do decide to make that shift from one territory to another, because they're going to have, like I say, that cultural inheritance is going to be closer to them now, so they can, take it up. But hopefully, it's also going to help to have a kind of functioning lobby or a functioning voice that can be heard and to articulate the needs and the requirements of this. Using these words is just difficult, but community, I mean, they're so fraught, but to help to articulate the needs and requirements of this community. And I hope that from now, It seems like it's not gonna, there's not gonna be any backsliding into obscurity again, We're,
Yeah, the subject.
I hesitate to say we, because I don't want to speak for anyone, but we're kind of here now, It's gonna be hard to pretend that we don't exist. And I just hope that more institutions come out and that even within these institutions and within people self-identifying and groups coming out, that there's going to be contention, there's going to be debate, there's going to be argument. That's healthy.
And of course, there's always that, how one, in any case, there's always these notions of credentials and where you stand and even generational shifts. Of course, all of these things, count for a huge amount in terms of one's identity and one's place in the social field, or where, what capacity, where you can situate yourself, all of these things. Whether you had to pay to go to art school, whether whether you fell or whether you were in or outside of that start of fees, and so on. I mean, I think there's so many different layers and histories around all of these things. Of course, far far too big to encapsulate in this conversation, for sure. But I think in a way we can point to them, and that's what we can do. Okay. Well, Morgan, it's been a joy as always to talk to you, and I encourage all our listeners to read your article, which is in this month's issue of Art Monthly. So thanks again for your time, Morgan,
Thanks
and
so much.
hope to see you soon. All right.
See you soon.